Hi, my name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic.
And my name's Kyle. I'm an alcoholic.
Kyle.
Kyle and I get together for at least an hour before this, prior to meeting here, because we want to give respect to the room and we want to reach some kind of consensus as the message we're bringing. So anything we say, we kind of both hammered out before we got here. So you could say, I speak for Kyle. Kyle speaks for me. Right, Kyle?
Yes.
So last week we talked, I promised everyone, I said, listen, there are a lot of ways and approaches to this book. I've been sober 18 years, so the interpretation I get from the book now is not the same interpretation I got from the book when I first went through it. And rather than try to sit here and bloviate about all the little nuances that you can capture in this text, I just wanted to focus on, like, if you guys were absolutely new, what would I do? How would I take someone who was absolutely new to this program through this work? And I'm always trying to change AA. Always trying to change AA. And in AA, there's a saying that says it's a simple program for complicated people. And I want to change that. I want to say it's a simple program for people who like to complicate things. Because it's not really that complex, this whole notion of getting sober and doing the 12 steps. It's really like a truck driver could do it. There's an expression, you cannot be too dumb to get the 12 steps, but you can damn sure be too smart. And we're going to find out tonight a little bit in Bill's story about how things like intellectual pride held Bill back from being able to accept the spiritual solution when that was put in front of him. To recap last week, we talked about the three big takeaways from the doctor's opinion. There's only three, no matter what you read in the doctor's opinion, right, there's three big takeaways. One of them is I have a physical allergy to alcohol, and when I take any alcohol into my body whatsoever, it triggers off this phenomenon of craving, and I have very little control over how much I'm going to drink or when I'm going to stop. Part of the message, that's okay, part of the message, oh my God, he got water on the tape recorder. This will no longer be preserved for posterity. Oh, Jesus, what am I going to do? But the bottom line is, right, as we were talking about this notion of this physical allergy as the first big takeaway, and the second one is that I will not be able to tell the truth from the false, that really alcoholics suffer from delusional thinking. And it goes, when we get to the more about alcoholism, it'll elaborate more deeply on what exactly that delusional thinking is. But for right now, let's just say that's the second big takeaway of the doctor's opinion. And the third big takeaway was not that I need to get with God or not that I need... The third big takeaway was I need a psychic change or some type of moral psychology. It's not hitting you. Like, I don't hit sponsees with the God hammer when I'm talking about the doctor's opinion. I just hit them with those three things. Look, something's got to change. Just one thing. What? Everything. And that's what's got to happen. So you have this allergy, you have this mental obsession, and something big has got to change. And if you got those three things, I move on. We always talk about the big book as far as the basic text of our society. It's right in the preface. This has become the basic text of our society. So therefore, when I bring people through this work, I treat it like a textbook. And like any good textbook, you have a definition of a problem, the doctor's opinion, an example of the problem, Bill's story, and the solution to the problem. Wow, what a thing. The third chapter is named There is a Solution. So once again, it's not a novel. I'm not going for like the deep interpretation of what Bill was thinking here or there. I'm just wanting to go with the big takeaways of the read. Once again, as I first go through it, I always ask myself, where am I in this text? I am not at the point where I'm talking about God, overly zealous about getting with God. I'm talking about a psychic change. I'm talking about some moral psychology, because I don't want to throw that out there right away. Bill had a lot of problems with that. When he went to first give this program out, he started opening up the God box right away. When he went back to Dr. Silkworth, Dr. Silkworth told him, that's not what I told you to do, Bill. That's not what I told you. Because Dr. Silkworth told him about the allergy and the mental obsession and phenomenon of craving. Those are the messages that at first can appeal to me because they make sense. So I always say, we're going to try to get through the first eight pages of this text. And thanks to a guy named Joe Hawk, I had this idea called, when you read the first eight pages of the text, we're going to try to see, where did I act like Bill? Where did I feel like Bill? And where did I drink like Bill? Can I identify any of those? Can I? Because really, where I am in the book now is trying to identify that I am an alcoholic. That's it. This is 50 pages of this book is basically identifying yourself as an alcoholic. Step one. We agnostics start step two, and that's 40 pages in. And the doctor's opinion used to be page one. It's now the appendix. That means about half this book. The whole solution is on 103 pages. So half of this book is dedicated to the proposition of whether or not I can diagnose myself as having an a problem. Because that's what I'm in. We talked about last week not being able to tell the true from the false. That if I lie to myself in alcoholism, can I lie to myself in recovery about wanting to get sober? And the answer is pretty much yeah, because lying is my default position. Then we're also going to look for examples. If this is a textbook, right, then we have this problem defined. Then Bill's story has to provide examples of this delusional thinking, examples of this inability to stop drinking. Examples are going to be there. So we're going to look for those too. And we're also going to look about, as we'll read through it, what Bill tried. Bill tried a few things. What did he try? And we're going to talk about those. And then I just wanted to say a quote that I heard this morning. I keep saying it again and again. And Denise, when you celebrated, it reminded me so much of it. It is, in reality, we are all just walking each other home. That's all we're doing. We're just walking each other home. And so, Kyle, you wanted to say some stuff about
just
point?
Real quick. You hear it a lot in beginners meetings, and you tell it to newcomers all the time. It's this idea of identify, don't compare. And that is so huge, especially when we go through Bill's story, because I've heard once or twice, especially from my sponsor, that I suffer in particular from something called terminal uniqueness, right? And when I first got here, I really compared, and I almost compared myself right out of the rooms, and that's really dangerous. And I struggled with Bill's story in particular because we went through a lot of different situations. It's not about specifically what the situation was. It's if we boil it down, can you identify with what he was doing, why he was doing it? You know, it's not about whether or not you were a stockbroker or a millionaire. It's can you identify with the feelings and with the drinking? Which after the first time I went through this, keeping that idea of identify, don't compare firmly in mind really helped me with this. Because the first time I went through it, I highlighted stuff and I didn't highlight a single thing because I was so focused on how different I was, you know. And that is dangerous. So I think we're about ready to kick things off.
Yeah, sure. You were going to talk about this first part.
Yeah,
right?
this first paragraph, you know, on page one. Here was love, applause, wars, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. You know, I was really awkward as a kid growing up, but when I started drinking, all of a sudden I fell in with like-minded people, and I really all of a sudden didn't feel like an outcast anymore. I felt like I belonged with these scumbags, right? Like, because I had a tendency to attract like-minded people to me, you know. For all that I was awkward and alone a lot of the time, all of a sudden when my addiction really took off, I was part of life at last. I belonged right out there. But at the same time, I had this awful tendency to burn bridges. You know, I don't know if that's just my terminal uniqueness acting up or if it's something that's very common to the alcoholic experience. But if I did one thing well and often, it was burning bridges. So sooner or later, and much more often sooner than later, I would find myself alone and lonely. And this last sentence of this first paragraph, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol, jumps at me right off the page. Because when I was drunk, I might have been alone, but I wasn't lonely, you know, as long as I was messed up.
And just to add on to that, Kyle, I would say if we're thinking about, you know, feeling, acting, and drinking like Bill, did you ever drink to enhance a moment? Because everything was exciting, and drinking added some element to it, right? It's like, wow, everything goes better with alcohol. I could totally identify with Bill there. When Bill said, I was lonely and turned to alcohol, I could identify that there were many times that I was lonely and I turned to alcohol. Now, I'm the kind of guy that could be in the middle of 100 people and be lonely. That's just the way it rolls, you know. A guy named Chuck C. said that the problem with alcoholism was just a kind of conscious separation from everyone. And I could be in a crowded room and feel alone. And sometimes that played into my drinking because I could get into that poor me thing. You know? Poor me, poor me, pour me another drink. Then it comes and he starts talking about, once again, the ego is terrible, and this overinflated sense of self that I did not realize was covering up a low sense of self-esteem is echoed or shadowed, as Bill says, I fancied myself a leader, for had not my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagine would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with utmost assurance. You know, the grandiosity that I'm going to do something and I'm going to show the world that I can do something, I could strongly identify with that. Although the thing was, I didn't want to do any of the work associated with that. I just thought fortune, fame and fortune was supposed to be thrown my way. I didn't realize there was actually work involved, and that caused a problem later on. You wanted to talk a little bit about that?
On the next page, page two, I'd proved to the world I was important. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. That takes me right back to being 17. I vaguely remember being so drunk at my SATs that I could barely sit in the chair. You know, I'm like trying very hard not to fall out of the chair. And then this is where I can absolutely identify with Bill's grandiosity. Men of genius conceived their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. You know, I used to be very into creative writing, and you know, my heroes, Joyce, Thompson, Hemingway, guys who would get blitzed and write and turn out these brilliant works. And I also used to be very, very into jazz and all the greats, all Billie Holiday, Cannonball Adderley, Monk, Davis. I in my grandiosity, and I was mediocre at best, right? But in my grandiosity, I thought that, hey, all these geniuses were getting messed up and churning out works of beauty. And I compared myself to them. Me, in my mediocrity, was comparing myself to them. You know, so just that deep-seated egomania, which is a fundamental part of my alcoholism, just jumps out at me. And I think you wanted to talk, you could identify with this as well.
I just wanted to point out, too, that you'll notice that as we read from each of the things, we're trying to connect it to a personal story that happened to us. This, we feel, makes the text come alive. It's one thing to just read it and give the instructional method of getting sober. It's another thing to connect something that actually happened to one of us, which we think makes the book come alive. I wanted to talk a little bit about that he said, by the time I had completed the course, I knew law was not for me. I'm reading a little ADD in there, you know what I mean? Like, I'm focused on this, but now I'm focused on that. And that's the way it was for me. I was really interested in this, and I really worked hard in this, but then, wait a second, I lost interest, and now I'm interested in this. And so I could strongly identify with those feelings. Now, when on the next page, on page three, he says, for the next few years, fortune through money and applause my way, I had arrived. Now, once again, to get back to this thing of boiling these statements down, you know, did you ever have a windfall of cash that out of nowhere, I don't know whether it was an inheritance, you hit the lottery, something, you came into some money, right? And then you felt, oh, this is it. My big break has come in. My ship has landed. I am now, it has arrived. I wasted that money, of course, and I squandered it away. But if you boil that statement down, maybe each of us, in a way, can remember a time when we had an opportunity, something where really we were going to do great if we just hung in there, and it just panned out. So I could identify strongly with that. And when he says drinking was taking on an important and exhilarating part of my life. You know, there's a time in my alcoholism / addiction that liquor did cease to become a luxury. You know, there was a time when I would go to the wine cellar. And this was in the beginning of summer, and I'd start building up my stock of wine for Thanksgiving. And I would have cases and cases of wine, and I would drink that wine, and I never got more than a month out of it. And I was wondering, what's going on? It was, drink was taking an accelerating part of my life. I was delusional, thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to save this, and this is a rare bottle of Merlot, and blah, blah, blah. And man, at the end, it comes into a big quart gallon of Gallo. I don't care. The Merlot turns into Gallo. Okay? So then this was a thing that I made a host of fair weather friends. Mm-hmm. Now, anybody who's hung out in a bar for more than 5 minutes knows that if you have money, you have friends. And you have plenty of friends. And all of those friends, you know, they're like there for you, they love you, you get arrested, none of them is showing up to court. Oh no, that's your mother and father are going to be in court maybe, and that depends on how many bridges you burn there. But I made a host of fair weather friends too, and you can tell your fair weather friends because once something horrible happens, they scatter, you know, like mice when exposed to light. I became a lone wolf. You know, there's a story I keep hearing over and over in Alcoholics Anonymous because I keep telling it to myself. And that is that this guy turned around and he said, when I started getting high and drinking and all this stuff, there was parties to go to and it was happening and there was women, it was exciting, there was music and rock and roll. He goes, but when I finished off, it was just me alone. In front of a glass table, and that glass table had a 6-pack of warm beer, a bottle of tequila, and some cocaine. And I didn't want anybody there because I wasn't looking to share anything with anybody. I became a lone wolf. And that resonated very strongly with me. Now, remember, reading these first 8 pages, the big objective, where I'm trying to identify if I have this. Do I have this? Because remember, the big thing in the back of my mind is I'm saying, there's this little voice saying, you're not really an alcoholic. These people are out of their minds. You just need to stop for a while and everything will get better. These are the thoughts that are going through my head when I'm first coming in. I'm not coming in to get sober. I'm coming in to lay low in the tall grass. And hopefully, when my shit cools down, everything will be all right. I could go back to the abhorrent behavior. Because, once again, we lie so much to myself, I can't tell the truth from the false. To me, I'm like a negative publicity agent. I'm constantly telling bullshit stories about myself to justify every horrible thing I've ever done. And it's like, how do you get out of that? I have to identify, I have to come to that jumping off place, and this is how Bill did it, and this is how I ask people to look at this text and say, can you identify with what's going on with Bill? Did you want to talk a little bit about any of that, Kyle?
Just, the remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row and I became a lone wolf. I did not hang out with nice people, right? I did not hang out with nice people. And when you're hanging out with a bunch of crackheads and they're telling you that you got a problem, you know, I didn't want to hear that. Because I know you're going down to South 19th and you're robbing people. But I got a problem, I'm done, you know? And towards the end, I very much so became a lone wolf because I, all of a sudden, I didn't want to share what I had with, like, that idea of not wanting to share what I had because I'm going to need all of this. All of it. It's going to take everything I have to get me right, you know? So that, I became a lone wolf. Yeah. The next thing that really jumps out at me is this, in the next paragraph, liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. So he contracted golf fever, right? And when I first went through this, it made no, it was like Chinese to me. Because for all that, I'm like a quarter Scottish, right? And I still just don't get golf. It makes no sense to me. So, but what are the feelings, right? We're boiling it down. Did you ever have something that you really wanted in life? But alcohol was more important. It's been several things for me. Flute lessons. I was taking very expensive lessons, but alcohol was more important. Having a career. You know, I was not... Well, I am the definition of somebody who was unemployable out there. But I would have these people say, you're so bright. And when you're sober, you're a hard worker. Why can't you get it? You know, you could go so far. And I couldn't, because I was drunk. So I can't identify with trying to catch up with a better golfer, you know. But this idea of my drinking was so important that it took precedence over every other thing in my life that I thought I cared about. Because I really thought I cared about it. But what did my actions state? That the most important thing was getting drunk. And then just golf permitted drinking every day and every night. You know, again, can't do the golf thing. Makes no sense to me. But I, about 2 years before I got clean, I started working at a pizzeria. And for those of you who have never worked food service, it's great for an alcoholic. I remember, like, one day, a couple months into the job, I had, like, a world-ending hangover. And one of the chefs was like, you're an idiot. And he pours me a glass of vodka. I'm like, are you insane? I'm going to puke everywhere. He's like, trust me, I'm much older than you. I've been through this before. Just trust me. And I'm like, all right, fine. I drank it. And hey, the hangover is gone. I'm drunk again. You know? And that's where I went. That's where things got really bad for me. That's when I started drinking in the morning about 2 years before I got clean. And that's where things really got bad. But just this idea of there came a point where I crafted a living situation. I found a job that permitted me to drink all day and all night.
And you were going to continue boiling here,
actually,
right?
Yeah. So again, not a stockbroker, 25-year-old white trash. But in the next paragraph, talking about the stock market crash. So here we're looking at some of the lies that he's telling himself. You know, he, first of all, his friends are jumping off the towers of high finance, and that disgusts him. He's not going to do that because he has his solution. His solution is drinking. I went back to the bar. And I, you know, we're going to talk about this. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later on, but this whole suicide thing is a recurring theme in my life, and something that I can totally identify with in Bill's story. But I was never more suicidal than when I was sober. You know, because the second I was messed up, I was fine. That was my solution. So he's lying to himself here, where because in our addiction we lose the ability to tell the truth from the false, right? Fundamentally. That's such a huge part of our addiction. So tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the fierce old determination to win came back. His career is in ruins. He's sitting in a bar, but he's going to win. Not sitting in the bar, he's not. So just this. So again, not a stockbroker, but we're boiling this down. What is he doing here? He's lying to himself. And his solution to this catastrophe that just struck him is to drink. And that I can identify with, because when calamity struck, I drank. I drank anyway, I was drinking anyway, but I really wanted it when catastrophe struck, you know. I drank happy, sad, rain, shine, Sunday through Monday. But like when I really wanted it, that was my solution to everything. So that, again, just we're trying to... Because I don't know. Personally, I feel that this makes a lot more sense if I can relate this to a particular situation in my life. It at least for me, when somebody took me through this work, it made the words come alive. And it wasn't just because I'm not a great student and I'm not great with textbooks, but all of a sudden it's somebody relating this experience to me in their own words. So I again can't identify with being a stockbroker, but I can absolutely identify with my solution being drinking.
And for me, it's like, yeah, I actually work in financial services, so there's a little more resonance here with me about what's going on. But to get back to what Kyle was saying about, you know, distilling this and boiling it down to a basic emotion, I have to ask myself, did a terrible thing or a terrible event ever happen to me? And rather than take an appropriate response and do what it was necessary, I decided to drink? Yeah, that happened a lot. So it may not have been the stock crash, but there were things in my life, times in my life, when situations really demanded that I be there. And I chose to opt out. And I made 100 excuses to drink. Oh, other people are jumping off buildings. Oh, this and that. I'm going to drink. It seems that it's funny, but every time I turn around, my solution for things seems to be to drink. So if I'm on this road of trying to understand how I thank, drank, and acted like Bill, but I'm also looking for some of the why the doctor's opinion, this story was picked by the doctor's opinion, you could clearly see the footprint of delusional thinking, right? And the doctor's opinion talks about will not be able to tell the truth from the false. All of a sudden, Bill keeps lying to himself. Now, the very next paragraph, the next morning, a friend telephoned from Montreal. He had plenty of money. And I better go to Canada the following spring. Living to my old accustomed style, I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. Right? Oh, victory. My friend had some more money. Now, I could go and continue the behavior. Now, that's the next thing. Maybe I didn't have that exactly happen to me, but did I ever get my ass saved at the last minute when some shit was going to happen? Did I ever get pulled out of the fire by a friend? Oh, maybe it was your parent. Maybe it was your loved one. And they provided me the opportunity to really save myself, even though I know I just messed up. And then I decide, hey, I'm going to drink again. Wow, look, I just lost every nickel I had. My solution is drinking, as opposed to kind of clearly thinking about what my next move is. And my friend saved my ass. My friend pulled me out of the fire. Now, a normal person might think, wow, I really had a close one there. I don't want that to happen again. I'm going to really do this right now. I'm going to straighten myself out. I'm going to get this thing on the road. That's not what Bill's thinking. Bill's thinking, hey, this is a great opportunity to behave like I always behaved. So once again, if I was trying to say, why did Bill's story get picked and why not Dr. Bob's as the second thing, as the example, right? Dr. Bob had a story too. It's that Bill's story is the perfect example and illustration of the delusional thinking, right? Of the obsessive behavior and so many people can identify with the way he thought, acted, and drank. I mean, it's really like if the doctor's opinion was the problem, Bill's story is the clear definition of what that problem is. And Bill, in my mind, is kind of suffering from a little bit of delusional thinking. And this is funny because he wrote this when he was sober. Wow. So even sober, the way I'm recounting, and we're going to see, and you might agree or not agree, but I ask you to just keep an open mind that some of the things Bill did, he soft soaps. So that doesn't sound as bad as it actually was. Let's see. I wanted to talk about, I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Now, I never hung around at brokerage places, but I damn sure was unwelcome. I was unwelcome a lot of places. You know, people just didn't want to hang out with me anymore. You know, unless, I had money. If I had money, oh, everybody loved me. But as soon as it really came down to, hey, look, do you like me? I was just not a likable person, you know? I always say to myself, you know, if you think I'm BSing tonight at all to you guys, because I'm trying to speak in the authentic voice, I always say, I always remember that I should act more like my wife. I should listen to her because she's kind, loving, compassionate, all the things that I basically have not had, right? And she's very understanding, and she listens to people, and I'm like, wow, how do you get those qualities, you know? Sometimes I think she should listen to me once in a while. But I know I should listen to her all the time. So if you think you're hearing a bunch of BS from me, you turn around and you look at that woman. If she's giving you the facha bruta, that means I'm full of shit. Okay? So I can bring my wife places because she knows. She knows. So, you know, hopefully, or I'm glad that I didn't have to go that far, you know, and lose the love of my life. But there's a very important paragraph which clearly illustrates the obsessive compulsive behavior and the allergy, and that is when he says on page 5, liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity. 100% that happened. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bar and delicatessen. Nets a few $100s, doesn't go help his wife. Doesn't go say, oh my God, Lois is working in an apartment store. Let me go see if I can help out, buy some groceries. Oh no, I got to pay my bar bill. That's what I got to do first. Priority one, take care of me. Okay, even in sobriety. He doesn't even realize it. It's a selfish, self-centered kind of thing. Right? I pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I was to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought that I could control the situation. Here you go. Imagine this. This is not a tumbler. Let's say maybe something twice this size is a tumbler, right? So you're waking up, you're violently shaking in the morning from alcoholic withdrawal, right? And you need a tumbler full of gin followed by 6 bottles of beer before you can even put down an egg, okay? Before you can even eat a bowl of cereal, you need that much alcohol, right? Wow. You talk about this man is heavily addicted to alcohol. That's very clear and obvious, right? But the next statement, nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. I said, if this is not a classic example of delusional thinking, I don't know what is. This is Bill lying, straight out lying himself. Hey, I could do this. I could handle this. And 100 times I woke up and said to myself, this has got to stop. I can't drink anymore. I can't get high. That's it. I'm going to kill myself. And nevertheless, I thought I could control the situation. See, I walked around with the first half of the first step for 5 years. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, 100%. Couldn't take it. But I was going to manage it, you know? My life had become unmanageable. That's the thing that stopped me in my tracks. And why? Intellectual pride. Pride is one of the 7 deadly sins. I thought I knew everything. And when you think you know everything, you can learn absolutely nothing. Because you know it all. So I come into the rooms. I have intellectual arrogance. I'm going to tell people how to get sober. And I'm wondering, why can't I recover? Why? Because I didn't get to that jumping off place. I want to say this. This is how come I can tell you Bill's soft soaps things just a little bit here. He says, gradually things got worse. Okay, gradually. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. Now, we know what that means today. He went into bankruptcy and he lost the house. He didn't write, I went belly up and I had to declare chapter 13. He didn't write that. Because that would have been too honest, too visceral, too real. He said, the mortgage holder took over the house. It's like an amicable thing. Here you go, mortgage holder. Here's the key to my house. The guy was kicked out of his house. He lost everything. Okay? So, once again, his solution. And then, you know, he got a promising business opportunity right away. He was going to share generously in profits. But he blew it. Once again. Did I ever have an opportunity to get sober? Maybe a new job, something that really was promising and really, you know, was like, wow, you know, you stick with this, Rich, and you're going to be me. And I blew it. Oh, I could totally identify with that. And then, Kyle, you could talk more about that, or you can...
Actually, I'm going to jump back just real quick.
Sure. Because,
so what... Rich has said it 1,000 times, and I'm probably going to say it 1,000 times more. What we're doing here is we're looking for examples of those 3 huge takeaways from the doctor's opinion, right? Physical allergy, mental obsession, and psychic change. And there's one sentence in this paragraph which Rich talked a lot about, but I think it also speaks loudly to the mental obsession, which is, I still thought I could control the situation. Right, because it is the single great obsession of every abnormal drinker that someday I'm going to control this thing. how many times, again, we're boiling this down where I'm trying to relate my personal experience to this, right? To make the words come alive a little bit. How many times did I wake up, and I don't know what the crap happened last night, but my face hurts and the bed is wet, you know? Because I was not a classy drunk, okay? But how many times, and I wake up and I'm never doing that again. And then an hour later, the thought comes. That thought. This time's going to be different. How many times? How many times was this time going to be different? 5,000, you know? Over and over and over again. And it was never different. Never. But that's our collective insanity. And I actually, gradually things got worse is a very soft way to put it, but I'm always trying to figure out what to say when I lead a speaker meeting. And I think it's a bit soft. It doesn't really convey like all the damage I did, but that's, you know, when I lead a meeting, I started drinking when I was shortly before I was 12. Gradually things got worse, and then, you know, I sobered up. That's because that's what happens. That's kind of the alcoholic experience summed up in one sentence, is we get worse. We don't get better. But the one thing I really wanted to talk about, because another huge thing that we're going to talk about here is what Bill tried. Right? Because he tried a couple of things to fix this alcoholic problem that he had. And a little further down the page, we have, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business. And so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. So, what we're seeing here is an example of how willpower failed him. Because willpower is not enough when you have this disease of alcoholism. And he meant business. And this, I can't speak for everyone else. I can only speak for me. But I meant business a lot when I was out there. You know, this time in sober, I'm a first-time winner, so to speak, but I really hate that phrase in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've had clean time before in other programs, in hospitals and outpatients. I've put together some time. And I've meant business before, you know, but there was no... We're going to talk a little bit later about there being a secret ingredient for getting this. And willpower isn't it. There is no willpower in me.
Did you try this too?
Oh yeah. And even further down the page, renewing my resolve, or was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and so I did. So here again, because again, I can't talk about everybody else, but I was a compulsive liar. I lied about everything. And here he's lying to himself. Confidence. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. He had that willpower that could keep him clean. Lies. And a recurring theme that I hope we're going to talk about throughout this workshop of ours is that I lied to myself in active addiction. I lied to everyone else, but most importantly, I lied to myself. And that doesn't change because I get sober and because I do the work. I'm still very capable of lying to myself. You know, but we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But just here, how many times, over and over and over again, how many times did I think, I've finally got this. I've got this figured out, man. You know, before I came into the rooms, February of 2015, I had something almost scare me into sobriety, and I put together like 3 or 4 days, because my sponsor says that alcoholics come in 2 varieties, binge spree drinkers and chronic drinkers, and I was a chronic drinker. You know, I drank all day, every day, for forever and ever and ever. I got to this point where I put together like 3 days without drinking, you know, and that was crazy, because I wasn't the kind of person who would drink hard for a week and then take a couple weeks off. I drank. You know, that's what I did. And there was a point where I didn't drink for 3 whole days. And I made what is arguably the most classic alcoholic mistake, and I thought, I got it, baby. I got it now. You know? How many times did willpower fail me? Because we're boiling this down. It's not about the specifics. It's about, can you identify with the feeling? And here this crops up again. Should I kill myself now? No, not yet. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So 2 bottles and oblivion. Here's that terminal uniqueness thing biting me in the ass again. A lot of people haven't experienced this suicidal ideation. There's a 12-step for that. I attend those meetings occasionally. So if you can't identify with suicidal ideation, if you can't identify with that jumping off place, if you can't identify with setting out with deliberate purpose, not just with the idle hope, but with the expectation of death, if you don't know what that's like, then all you have is a not yet. Because trust and believe that to live in untreated alcoholism is to die early. That's what happens. So if you don't get that yet, then all you have is a not yet. Because suicide is the enemy. And that's where my drinking takes me. You know, and I can't speak for everyone else. But if you can't get that, you have a not yet.
And Kyle, I'd like to add something to that too. This notion of the self-centeredness and the self-pity. If you wind that back a little bit, and Bill gets into the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street, lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. And all night play supplied me with 12 glasses of ale. My wreathing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I would not. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's Bill getting close to that jumping off place. I say that's Bill still in that self-centered, self-pitying mode of look at all the things. I was going to commit suicide. Look at how bad things got for me. You know, I was thinking in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard early on, it's like everyone comes in like an opera singer, you know, everything's like me, 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 me. Everything is centers around me. You know, I'm not very much, but I'm all I ever think about. And here he is consumed. He's not saying, oh my God, you know, I thought, oh, you know, what's going to happen to my poor wife, blah, 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 nothing. It's just about me. How I felt, what I was going to do. Oh, God, I almost threw myself through a window. You know, God, the amount of suffering he wreaked on other people, you know, hey, come on. And then the next paragraph, again, he soft-soaping it a little bit, he says, sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse. Sometimes. Not all the time, sometimes. Okay? I'm a blasting alcoholic. I need tons of alcohol. I have no source of income. There were some times when I passed by my wife's purse, I saw her bulging with money. I didn't take a dime. I did not take a dime. Bullshit. Okay? I had that feeling. I didn't stop taking money from people because all of a sudden I felt qualms of conscience when I was drinking. I took the money. That's all I did. It wasn't a sometimes situation. He robbed this woman blind, and that was all there is to it. But he couldn't say, hey man, I robbed her blind. Because when I'm in the throes of addiction, I don't care about people that love me. I don't care about my family, my mother. I can't tell you how many times as a teenager I stole money off my mother, and I was raised on public assistance. She really needed that money. But I needed to get high more than she needed to eat. This was just a reality.
Did you, I think last night you talked about this a little bit. Did you want to mention?
Oh, well, you know, I think in a lot of senses, when you think about this notion of wanting to kill yourself, it's another form of self-pity. I don't kill myself. I'm too selfish and self-centered to do that. The first thing I'm going to do is destroy everybody around me. I'm going to make everybody's life miserable. I'm going to make people regret they ever knew me. I'm going to make people suffer. Because that's what I do. I don't have the chutzpah to kill myself. I'm too self-absorbed. How could I edit the world without me? Jesus, who would want to deprive the world of that? You know, so I can't do that. Oh, and then there's a geographic that he pulls. Oh,
did you want to talk?
And that was the big thing. Thanks for reminding me, Carl. I have to understand. I mean, Kyle. Actually, I call him Carl because Carl's my sponsor. I have Carl. Carl Bull's my sponsor, if anyone wants to know. And I just have him as my sponsor because I want people to think I'm really sober. So when I say, who's your sponsor? I say, Carl. And they go, ooh, he must be really sober. But there is four outcomes to this lifestyle. There are only four outcomes. And I have to remember them. They are death, institutions, jails, or recovery. There's no fifth door here. And I had some people turn around, well, what kind of death are we talking about? That's an option. It's an option. All right, so let's see now. Oh, and then at the end he goes, there were flights from the country where he went back and forth. You know, that's like the old thing of he pulling a geographic, right? But the bad news is, you know, wherever you go, there you are. Okay, and boom, you can't get away with that. Go ahead, Kyle.
I heard a great quote not too long ago, and I shared this at First Things First a couple of weeks ago. A darkness carried in the heart cannot be cured by moving the body from one place to another. There is no geographic cure. But God, didn't we try? You know?
Let's talk about the first addict in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm.
How much time do we got left?
8 minutes.
Okay, we have 8 minutes left. That's good, because we were only going to cover the first 8 pages of Bill's story anyway, and we're rounding this out, and we're on page 7. So we're doing pretty good, right, Denise? All right, good. And thank you for being a good spiritual timekeeper, because, you know, I could speak for a long time.
We took her anniversary, too.
Oh, okay.
Self-knowledge.
Right, but this I think is, okay. I want to cover this. I want to say, Bill turns around and says, somehow I managed to drag my mattress to the lower floor. Oh my God, at least I suddenly leave. Oh, the world would be going without Bill. The doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. You know, there's a big well of feeling in Alcoholics Anonymous that it's a signalness of purpose, and I respect that, and I understand that. But if everybody who ever smoked a joint, took a little cocaine, or took a pill, got up and walked out of this room, I think we'd have maybe like one person here. Okay? It's the times that we live in. So if you're an addict and an alcoholic, I have some good news for you. There's recovery for you too. Do you know, when the first junkie came into Alcoholics Anonymous, they did not want to let him in.
Yeah.
There was only one member of the group that said let him in. And you know who that member was? That was Bill W. He said, let that guy in. Because this is not about alcohol per se. This is about anything that affects me from the neck up. Anything that I use to get me out of myself. And for people that have these problems, you know what? Our road is all-inclusive. It is not exclusive. I did say when I came here I was going to say some controversial things. And I invite you all to just think about it. You know, this is a program of take what you need and leave the rest. But I can't help it. I have to say that because this is what my truth is. I can't tell you what the truth is. I can only tell you what my truth is. And my truth is I welcome everyone in this room. Now, he met a doctor, and the doctor explained to him about the physical allergy. And this was the second thing Bill tried. He said, surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. Well, he tried willpower, and now he's got self-knowledge. Someone told him, hey, you got an allergy. And you got this mental obsession that once you take a drink, you have too little control of when you're going to stop. And then once you wake up in the morning and say you're never going to do it again, you have this mental obsession that tells you somehow it's going to be different this time. And Bill's going, wow, eureka, I found it. This is it. I know. What's going to cure me, Carl?
Self-knowledge.
Self-knowledge. But you could take this sentence.
But it was not.
Okay.
For the frightful day came when I drank once more.
So once again, to move this along a little bit, right? Bill tried willpower. Bill tried self-knowledge. None of these things seem to work, right? So rather than get into a little bit more about what's going on, I'm going to give everybody assignment for next week. When we come back, I want everyone to read the next 8 pages of Bill's story, and I want to ask you one question, just answer, would I be willing to do what Bill did to get sober? Just say that. You know, he has some clear-cut things that he did. And ask yourself, would I be willing to do this? Now, of course, you know, we didn't get to the part where Bill's on the balls of his ass, and he gets to the jumping-off place, which I believe everybody has to get to. And I'll close it with saying, no words could tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Once again, self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I was overwhelmed, and alcohol was my master. This was the beginning of Bill's awakening of that he was powerless over alcohol. But he still had to try it again just one more time. So, you know, they say, watch out, every rock bottom has a trap door. Every rock bottom has a trap door. And Bill fell through one more trap door, and then he changed. And if you come back next week, we're going to tell you the secret ingredient that Bill found that made him sober. So please come back. It's a thriller. You're not going to want to miss it. Okay.